Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Academy Awards ranked choice method of voting as an example of a model for American democracy, inasmuch as Academy members are able to express their true preferences voting with their hearts and heads. Rob Ritchie, the Executive Director of Fair Vote, joins us to discuss how ranked choice or instant runoff voting is being implemented across the country and is being considered for statewide elections. Then we'll look into the latest scandal in the Vatican that the Italian newspaper La Repubblica claims was the cause of the Pope's resignation. Francis Kissling, the former president of Catholics for Choice, joins us to discuss the alleged secret papal dossier about a network of gay church officials inside the Vatican who were being blackmailed by a male prostitution ring. Francis has an article at The Nation, A New Pope, African, Latin American, Woman, Nice Guy, Will Change Nothing. Then finally, we'll get an update on today's election in Italy, where the current prime minister is polling in fifth place behind the comedian Beppe Grillo, who drew a crowd of 500,000 in Rome denouncing crooked politicians and bankers. Domenico Lombardi, an expert on the ongoing European crisis that could be impacted by a stalemate in Italy, with the centre-left coalition barely holding on, while Berlusconi's Freedom People Party is showing strength as the scandal-plagued ex-prime minister offered a $5.3 billion gift of his own money to Italian voters, while running an anti-austerity campaign against the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Joining us now is Robert Ritchie, the co-founder and executive director of Fair Vote, formerly called the Center for Voting and Democracy. He writes, speaks, and testifies frequently on issues of voting and democratic participation. Prior to founding the center, he worked for three winning congressional campaigns in Washington State and for the nonprofit organizations in Washington and the District of Columbia. He's a co-author of two books, Every Vote Equal and With Stephen Hill, Whose Vote Counts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Ritchie.
Thanks so much, Ian. Pleased to be on the program.
Well, bear with me. I've got a terrible chest cold, but just explain to us that. I mean, what we're seeing tonight at the Academy Awards is an example of the simplest form of democracy, the fairest form of democracy that exists, and I don't understand why we don't have it. So explain why it is so much fairer. And then why we don't have it?
Yeah, well, I'll first mention, and I'll get into the core way to change the vote first in a moment. But just the nominations themselves are actually done in a very.
Sorry,
shift phones. I don't know what happened there.
Right.
I was just saying the nominations are done by a form of proportional representation. So to get nominated for, you know, best actor or one of these awards, you need the strong support of about, you know, 15 to 20% of the Academy voters in that category. So they do that. So they get kind of a fair reflection of the full range of preferences that members of the Academy have, so that people all have like a stake in the outcome tonight. And then for best picture, which, of course, is, you know, the biggest award in most people's minds, and they have nine nominees this year. Rather than just vote for one and say the winner is the one with the most votes, even if that might be, say, only 15% or 18% or whatever might be the most votes, they use instant runoff voting or a ranked choice voting system where you get to rank your candidates. Actually, the Washington Post has a really cool app that you can go to their site and, you know, use the ranked choice ballot to get a feel for how it works, where you get to say, here's my first choice, but here's my second choice and third choice. So you do that as a voter, and then they use those votes, those rankings, to determine really who is the movie that balances having strong first choice support, like it, you know, has enough votes to get up there in the top, you know, two, three, four movies in first choices, but also is an attractive movie to supporters of other movies, so that it can get second choices from those that are getting knocked out during the course of the count. They do a series of what we call instant runoffs, where the last place movie is knocked out. You look at those ballots, you add them to the totals of the other movies. You end up getting down to two, and the winner is the one that more people prefer. So you end up sort of getting rid of the whole spoiler impact. And, you know, the next time you're thinking about a partisan election and thinking of voting outside the major parties or wanting to vote for someone you're not sure can win, but you really like them, this system allows you to do that without giving up a chance to indicate your sort of lesser of two evils choice. And it's one of the many good examples out there of this system being used and working.
And it does seem that the spoiler factor operates everywhere, does it not? I mean, throughout the country. I mean, an example, for example, is in the state of Maine, where the independent Elliot Cutler and the Democrat Libby Mitchell split the vote, electing instead Republican Paul LePage with 38% of the vote. And he's governed as though he had a mandate, despite more than 60% of the public actively voting against him. That's more common than not across the United States. It happened in 2000 with George W. Bush.
Right, that's the sort of with top of the heap kind of, you know, whoever gets the most votes wins kind of approach, and that's fine when you only have two choices, because whoever has the most votes will have more than half the votes. But if you have three or more choices, that first place winner, you know, they're in first, but they may actually be strongly opposed. And the main example is a great one, because it was like 38, 37, 20, something like that, and it was clear that if LePage had faced off against Cutler, he would have lost by probably 15, 20 points. And yet instead he won. And as you say, he's been governing as if he deserved it. And what's interesting is he's keeping his base relatively happy. So the polls are showing for his reelection. You know, he's at 35, 40% approval, which would usually mean that he would probably lose. However, once again, Cutler's going to run as an independent, and a Democrat will likely run, and it's quite possible that they'll split the vote again. So that's kind of an extreme example of how it can, you know, really just, you know, give us bad outcomes. But also, just any time that we want to consider a choice who we really like but think they can't win, a lot of people end up not voting for them, and that's sort of depriving us almost of candidates in the first place who might offer an alternative perspective, just someone who can say, I disagree with both major parties, and there's certain things that I want to raise and have our nation or our state have a conversation about, but we even like curtail the conversation because of a system that turns that candidate into a spoiler.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Ritchie, the co-founder and executive director of Fair Vote, formerly called the Center for Voting and Democracy. He writes, speaks, and testifies frequently on issues of voting and democratic participation. Prior to founding the center, he worked for three winning congressional campaigns in Washington State and for nonprofit organizations in Washington and the District of Columbia. He's the co-author of two books, Every Vote Equal and with Stephen Hill, Whose Vote Counts. So, I'm so sorry. So tell me, there's a number of cities throughout this country that have passed instant or ranked choice voting, like the Academy operates on. Minneapolis, St. Paul, they're apparently going to be electing their mayors with a ranked choice voting this November. Cities like San Francisco, Oakland, and Portland, Maine already have the system, do they not?
Yes. And in fact, that Portland experience is partly why there's so much interest in Maine in going to ranked choice voting, because they have this clearly broken situation in the statewide level, and they have had this great experience at a local level of it working in their biggest city. And, you know, they had a really excellent mayoral election. In fact, it was remarkable. They had 15 candidates, which is a lot more than you might usually have in any kind of election, but it's the first race for mayor, and a lot of people wanted to give it a shot, and ranked choice voting worked wonderfully. People, you know, turnout was much higher than expected. Voters handled the ballot. People felt the candidates did a great job of kind of reaching out to more voters, and that kind of experience is what has led people to think it would be a good thing to use statewide. And also, as you say, it's going to be used in the Twin Cities this November. Very interesting open seat race for mayor in Minneapolis, and they've used it in other cities as well. And I think, you know, Los Angeles is having a runoff election for mayor, and that does something similar, but a two-round runoff can also, at least for some kinds of runoffs, you know, have much lower turnout, campaign finance demands, it costs a lot more money to run. So it's being considered as an alternate approach to those traditional runoffs as well.
Well, Robert Ritchie, of course, in Australia, they've already for some time, actually for decades, they've had what they call preferential voting, which is the same, instant runoff voting, where you vote 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And, you know, in their last regularly contested parliamentary elections, they had an average of 7 candidates participating in every seat. You know, the Green Party ran in every seat, and, you know, parties on kind of the left, right, and center. And no one talked about spoilers, right? They could just run and contest and make their points known. And it's not proportional representation, which, by the way, for a legislature, that's what I really want to ultimately see, where, you know, 10% of the vote actually wins 1 out of 10 seats. But it's a system that at least accommodates voter choice, allows us to have a freer range of debate, and, you know, one that has been proven to work.
Well, in Australia, the Green Party, you know, of course, has a lot of influence because in forming coalition governments, they have a lot of clout. Whereas in 2000, of course, it was the 96,000 votes for Ralph Nader that allowed Bush to win by 516 votes, at least to a lot of...
Yep, that's exactly right. And what's interesting is they have this, you know, they use instant runoff, the ranked choice voting system in the House elections. For their Senate, they have proportional representation. Because the Greens have been able to kind of run and build support and not have people call them names, and, you know, they're now up to getting more than 10% of first choice support, that's not helping them win too many seats. They actually do have a couple seats, I think, one or two, in the House, but it has contributed to them building support in the Senate. So now they actually have, you know, a fair share of seats in the Senate, and that's where they can get all the more influence. So they kind of get two kinds of influence. One, in the House side, they can get their message out. They can force the major parties to confront what they have to say and, you know, change some views and reach out to their voters to be, you know, second choices. And then they can convert that positive response to what they're saying into actually winning seats in the proportional representation half up in the Senate.
So why do you think it is in the United States that we, even though we celebrate our democracy, we don't actually have a very fair system?
Well, we tend to be creatures of habit or whatever we've done, thinking that we have to keep doing. It's an important thing to always remember that we should be examining first principles and rules. And we have a great value of being an old democracy that goes back to the 1700s, but we have the great problem of being an old democracy that thinks its ways are sort of the way you have to do things. And we don't tend to learn a whole lot from other countries. And frankly, we don't learn enough from what we already do, which is that sense that we already have cities using instant runoff voting. We already have cities using forms of proportional voting. But we don't tend to necessarily think about that experience when we're, you know, wringing our hands about how bad Congress is functioning or frustrations with other parts of our process. And I think that if we open our minds, and that's what Fair Vote's really trying to do, people can check out a lot of good ideas and good ways of moving forward at fairvote.org. But I think it's this is a great example. It's sort of, you know, it's a very straightforward idea. You got to work on some of the implementation issues, make sure the voting machines get adapted to be able to handle a ranked choice ballot, and which they can. It just takes, you know, it takes some attention to those kinds of things. Then we can make this work.
And of course, given our system of spoilers, whether it's somebody that is splitting the vote, or in some cases the opposite party secretly funds the candidate that they think is the weakest. I mean, you know, if that was happening in the Academy Awards, the idea that you would tell a movie director not to make a movie because another director might lose their Oscar, I mean, that's ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that is a nice part of this system that, you know, that it's not something that there's been ever any successful efforts to try to game it tactically. The one thing that's interesting is that they don't use it for most of their categories, and that's because they actually want upsets. It's sort of exciting on Oscar night to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe that, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis is not the best actor. Everyone thought he was going to be best actor. And he almost certainly would be, using him as an example. He probably will win anyway, but let's say by plurality somehow he didn't win in an instant runoff, you know, the right outcome kind of would have been delivered. So they actually want some upsets. So they don't use it for most things. But they do want it for Best Picture because they want to make sure the Best Picture really is the legitimate, worthy winner.
So, Rob Richard, just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about the Los Angeles elections here for mayor, because it's just talk about voter fatigue already. They're having a primary election, and then in March sometime they're going to have, I think it's next Tuesday is the first round, and then later in March they're going to have, I guess, the runoff round.
I think it's actually like they wait a long time. They maybe wait a couple months or something because they have to kind of redo the ballots and send them out to people overseas. And it's an interesting thing because people are pretty sure you won't get a winner in the first round, but it will be a very important election for narrowing it down to two. But it sort of disperses the energy of the voters, because some voters won't turn out this week because they'll say, well, it's not the real election. That's going to be the runoff. But, of course, it's going to limit most of the choices people have in the runoff. And some of the races will be decided because if you get more than 50%, you're done. That's the California top two model for all your state and federal races now, by the way. It's, that first round that people vote in is critically important because it narrows the field to two and knocks out most candidates. And yet, voters were pretty uninspired last year in that first round and didn't really show out. So we need to kind of educate people. Whenever you have a runoff system, you really need to raise awareness that both rounds really matter. One alternative is to try to compress them into an instant runoff, and that's what San Francisco and Oakland and San Leandro and Berkeley have done. Four California cities now don't have runoffs, but instead use the ranked choice voting system.
But already, it's pretty clear that the race is pretty much decided between Wendy Gruhl and I'm sorry, I can't even think of his name. Eric Garcetti.
Oh, is it Eric Garcetti?
So the idea that they're going to spend twice as much or at least as much again. In following the first election, it just invites a flood of money. And, we'll get to a point soon where you're going to have to have $1 million to run for dog catcher.
Yeah, we came really close. There was a very strong effort to get instant runoff voting, ranked choice voting for mayor in L.A., and, both the AFL-CIO and Chamber of Commerce supported it, and your former mayor Reardon supported it, and kind of people on the left and right. I think Garcetti was a supporter on the council, and it just never. I think it was one vote short on the council of getting onto the ballot. So we'll see coming out of this election whether people say maybe it's time to just have a single round focused ranked choice vote. So people should keep in mind that there is a long history of the LA City Council debating this. It's a good thing to follow up with on people in Los Angeles. Well, there's a group called Californians for Electoral Reform, CFER.org, which is organizing on these issues in California if people want to get involved.
I thank you so much, Rob Ritchie, for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Rob Ritchie, the co-founder and executive director of Fair Vote, formerly called Center for Voting and Democracy. He writes, speaks, and testifies frequently on issues about voting and democratic participation. Prior to founding the center, he worked for three winning congressional campaigns in Washington State and for nonprofit organizations in Washington and the District of Columbia. He's the co-author of two books, Every Vote Equal and with Stephen Hill, Whose Vote Counts. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about a secret dossier which apparently contains the reasons why the Pope resigned.
You don't need to change. The future's ours. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Frances Kissling. She was president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007 and is currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory board of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and Women's Bioethics Project. She is a consultant to the Western Hemispheric region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, where she develops and conducts values clarification workshops for doctors and nurses working on reproductive health in Latin America. She has an article at The Nation, A New Pope, African, Latin American, Woman, Nice Guy, Will Change Nothing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Hi, Ian. Nice to be with you.
And in the title of your article at The Nation, you put woman in there. That's a snowball's chance in hell?
Yes, that is definitely a snowball's chance in hell. But the way things are going, we may well see some snowballs in hell.
Well, tell us about what's going on with Repubblica and Panorama, these two major newspapers in Italy. It's caused quite a flap. The Vatican has so strenuously denied the reports that, it's sort of, he doth protest too much. But tell me about what you understand of these reports to contain.
Right. Well, there are so many scandals in the Vatican. It's sort of an ongoing occupation. But there had been a number of scandals. Most recently, when the Pope's butler was accused of having leaked information about the Vatican Bank and corruption within the bank to the media, that a commission of three cardinals was set up to look into that leak and to basically look into, generally speaking, what was going on around the bank and around leaks in the Vatican. And that report was delivered to the Pope about 2 weeks ago. And apparently, or at least what the newspapers are saying, is that the report also contains extensive material about, they say, prelates, so it could be anywhere from priests to cardinals, who are engaged in homosexual behavior and who are being blackmailed by worldly sources, both around the sexuality issue and around corruption in the banks. And that's about as much as we know, and that this was sort of the last straw, as Andrew Sullivan put it, the last red Prada shoe to drop in terms of the Pope deciding that he had to resign.
So those
are the outlines of the of what's available at this point in time.
So this 300-page dossier compiled by three cardinals who are going to be voting for a new Pope, they were given to the Pope a few weeks ago, and they were labeled pontifical secret, apparently. And the speculation is that that was what caused the Pope to resign. But is it any of this constant drip, drip, drip of scandal? It doesn't seem to have any effect. Now, you could argue that because this report revealed this kind of activity inside the Vatican itself, maybe the Pope could handle the idea that the American Church is gone off the rails, but right in under his own roof. Maybe, I don't know, I'm speculating.
Yeah. Well, I think that I am sure this is not the first time that the Pope has heard that there are prelates working in the Vatican and around the Vatican who are homosexual and who are active. These kinds of reports come out from time to time. I can't remember the source of it, but there was several years ago, one of the TV stations followed around. I went to various gay bars in Rome where prelates were known to hang out, and there was some videotaping of them. Those of us who have friends, anybody who has any friends in Rome or who is remotely close to things that are going on in the church, hears rumors. I've heard rumors for years about various cardinals, including American cardinals, who during their time in Rome were known to be active homosexuals. I mean, I've never felt any need to repeat any of it. I still don't feel any need to repeat any of it. But it's not, you know, the Pope was, there is no doubt in my mind that this Pope and any Pope at any point in history would be the least bit surprised to know that there are among his bishops and among his priests, men who are actively homosexual.
Well, of course, Francis Kissling, what gets confused here is the child sex abuse and homosexuality, and they have no relationship. And the Ghanaian cardinal, who many think might be the next pope, he made some extremely reactionary remarks about homosexuality, saying in Africa that we don't have that problem.
Yes.
And he's also apparently said strangely sympathetic things about these horrible anti-gay laws that are being passed in Uganda and other countries. So what do you think the chances of him being the next pope? I mean, I guess I've got to preface that by saying that every one of these cardinals was either appointed by the outgoing pope, who's just resigned, Benedict, or his predecessor, John Paul, right?
That's right.
So they're all ultra-conservatives. They're fundamentalists, frankly.
Well, I mean, I think that you know, I mean, they vary to some extent. I wouldn't call all of them ultra-conservative, but I think the large they are conservative, and they have taken conservative views on any number of issues. You know, the African cardinals have their own problems that came out some time ago, about 10 years ago, when one of the orders of nuns that works in Africa wrote two scathing reports over a 10-year period about the prevalence of priests who force Catholic nuns in Africa into sexual relationships with them. Very much along the lines that we know of the mythology around, well, and basically the priests believed that nuns would be celibate, and therefore they would be having sex with women who did not have HIV, and therefore they would be free of getting the disease. And this is well documented, well reported. The cardinals and bishops in Africa did nothing about it, and the Pope did nothing about it. I mean, you know, this is unfortunately a, you know, which goes back to what I said in my Nation piece, you know, this really is a church where the kind of corruption we are seeing today, whether it is greed, sexuality, abuse of people on many, many levels, it begins to rival what you see of the Borgia popes on television and read in books. It's really a level of corruption that is beyond shocking.
But what's strange about this, Francis Kissling? And again, I'm speaking with Francis Kissling, who is was the president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007, and she's now a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and Women's Bioethics Project. And she's a consultant to the Western Hemispheric region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation. Now, you would think that with all of this scandal, and now this latest scandal, if you're to believe the La Repubblica and Panorama, which is not that well-sourced, and a lot of people are skeptical about these reports. And of course, as I mentioned, the Vatican have really strenuously denied them. But nevertheless, you would think that in the real world, after all of this money and scandal, and the Irish church is all but finished. I mean,
yes.
Nobody's showing up in Ireland now. They're so disgusted. And I imagine it's happened here to some extent in the United States. I bet the attendance is way down and the money is way down. So you'd think that...
Well, actually, it's not. That's a piece of the problem. And when you look at these things, these scandals come up in a variety of places. You know, and when you look at the U.S., I mean, when the scandal, this round of sex abuse scandals broke in 2002 with the Boston Globe, you know, this really wonderful organization called Voice of the Faithful was developed, and, you know, to deal very narrowly with questions around sexual abuse in the church. And the cover-up of it. You know, these were not radical people who wanted women ordained. They didn't have any agenda on contraception. They just wanted the sex abuse to stop. And they believed that they would, you know, they bragged and hoped that they would get 10 million Catholics as members. You know, throughout that entire period from 2002 forward, you know, they never went above 50,000 members. And their budget never went above $600,000, and they, you know, were closing their office and unable to pay their staff and all of this. So it's very difficult to understand how ordinary people, you know, the vast majority of Catholics, just let this kind of thing go by, that it doesn't outrage them enough for them to say, we've had it. We're not giving our money. We're going to go to another, we're going to join another religion. They, you know, I mean, American Catholics are really quite apathetic in large numbers. I know that right now there are a number of Catholics in, you know, California who are protesting Cardinal Mahoney's participation in the conclave. Because of his involvement in the sex abuse scandal, as transfers of priests, etc. You know, so you get a narrow band, really a narrow band of Catholics who seem to think that their priests and their cardinals should be saintly men who lead exemplary lives. And either most Catholics don't care whether their cardinals or bishops are saintly and lead exemplary lives, or they're just not reading the newspaper.
Well, you mentioned Cardinal Mahoney here in Los Angeles, the biggest Catholic diocese in the country. A petition of 10,000 signatures was handed to his office yesterday by a group called Catholics United. He apparently has gone to Rome, and on the local news coverage last night, they were showing his Twitters that he does tweeting now, and said, I'll be in Rome for the conclave, and I'll keep tweeting you with updates. Of course, I can't tweet from the conclave, but you're in my prayers or something. And it's all sort of designed to show that he's sort of hip in a way.
Yes.
But, you know, without reaching here, it doesn't seem like he gets it neither. I mean, I don't think any of them get
it. Well, listen, you know, you're dealing with a level of corruption among high-ranking prelates that is very high. And so that, you know, Cardinal Mahoney and his colleagues have a lot to answer for, and none of them have felt that they have to answer for it, whether it's the cardinals in Belgium or the cardinal, you know, the cardinals and bishops in Ireland, the African cardinals, the cardinals and bishops in the Philippines who received the priests from the United States who were sent over. The level of corruption is very high. And what happens is, as happens with any cohort of people who hang out with each other, you reinforce that kind of corruption and consider it normal. And when nobody does anything about it, you know, when these kinds of incidents are reported quite regularly and have been reported quite regularly to the Vatican and to higher-ranking officials in the church, you know, over, say, even we just look at it in modern times, over the past 50 years, and nothing is done. And so everyone who is part of that system believes they are immune from any disgrace, opprobrium, expectation of normal behavior.
Well, I know, Francis, you're just back from Tanzania in Africa, so you may have missed a recent article in the New York Times about a Monsignor in Connecticut who was dealing methamphetamine and having all kinds of wild sex parties and stuff. It was an unbelievable story. I mean, it just, as I say, this latest one from La Repubblica, the idea that a network of gay prelates in the Vatican are being blackmailed, and it may have something to do with the bank, the Vatican Bank, is pretty breathtaking. But just to go to the conclave, which starts soon, and the Pope, you know, the suspicion from these articles is that this was too much for the Pope, this study or this secret report by these three cardinals. You've got the cardinals from Italy responsible for the destruction of the Catholic Church in Ireland. You've got the cardinals from Ireland responsible for the destruction of the Catholic Church in Ireland voting. You've got Mahoney voting over here, which a lot of local Catholics tried to stop but were unable to do. And so it goes on. Is there anybody in that whole conclave that is a little more pragmatic, has a little more compassion and humanity, and recognizes that they've got to get up to the 21st century and start? I mean, isn't it true that most of them aren't recruited from priests that are out there in the field? They're mostly sort of recruited as church bureaucrats?
Yes. I mean, it's very much, you know, when John Paul II came in, he set about a very strategic move to ensure long-term conservatism and loyalty to the system among the cardinals. He appointed, and Ratzinger has followed that, and as you noted earlier, almost all of the, I think all of the cardinals who are under 85, which is the age at which they can no longer vote, right now have been appointed by those two men. And he appointed young men so that their ultimate formation, you know, I mean, they weren't in their 20s, but, you know, men in their 30s and their 40s to become cardinals, who therefore had a lot of time to develop their mature adult attitudes, if one can say that, in the Vatican and as cardinals. He appointed a lot of bureaucrats, a lot of people who had served the church as either ambassadors or professors or just functionaries within the Vatican. And he deliberately, it would seem, there was a deliberate effort, or people who had worked in dioceses in their own countries. There was a deliberate effort, it seemed, not to appoint men who had come up through the priesthood and served in poor areas as parish priests, who might have some real understanding of the lives of ordinary people. But, you know, he basically appointed the heads of the, you know, like if this was IBM, if you could compare this to IBM and Rome was the international headquarters, he appointed the CEOs and the CFOs and the researchers from the national offices of IBM. And so we, you know, we have a very corporatized church, combined not only with a corporate mentality of protecting the institution, but also with a kind of sense of personal opportunism, which is which really, you know, does permeate. Now, you know, a lot of the guys are pretty good actors, and they learned how to, you know, play jolly fellow, well-met, back-slapping kind of guys. But when it comes right down, you know, it's a bunch of pretty ruthless characters. And increasingly, we are seeing a level of corruption at either financial or sexual levels that is you know, does not speak well of something, of a church whose ultimate leader is supposed to be infallible.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Frances Kissling.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Frances Kissling, former president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She's a consultant to the Western Hemispheric region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation. She has an article at The Nation, A New Pope, African Latin American Woman, Nice Guy, Will Change Nothing. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about today's Italian elections. I know you made me.
the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Domenico Lombardi, who's an expert on G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations, and global currencies. His current project focuses on the recent international financial crisis, the ongoing European crisis, and reforms of the IMF and the World Bank. Welcome to Background Briefing, Domenico Lombardi.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you're following the Italian elections, of course, and I think everybody in Europe is concerned, are they not? Because if Monti, Mario Monti, the technocrat who brought in the austerity measures that are so unpopular, he's just dropping like a stone. And if that continues, the center-left coalition won't have enough seats, and therefore you'll have stalemate with Berlusconi causing more mischief, I would imagine.
Yes, that's right. It's really a hard election, this, because this election is being held against the background of a falling economy. Last year, the income actually dropped by 2.2%. This year, it's going to be more than 1%. And clearly, there is a lot of unhappiness about the austerity policies led by the technocratic government of Mario Monti. So that said, clearly this has reinvigorated Mr. Berlusconi's coalition. He has been running a campaign, against Merkel, against the euro, against the sort of German-imposed austerity policies. And this, of course, has given him some traction, especially in the latest few weeks, with the consequence that if you look at the latest polls, clearly Mr. Berlusconi's coalition has gained quite some steam, and it's not clear at all whether the center-left will be able to muster a majority in both chambers. Most likely, when be unable to have a majority in the upper chamber, in the Senate, and therefore will have to seek an alliance with the Mr. Monti centrist group.
But the surprise in this election, and he's actually coming in third, is the comedian, Pepe Grillo, right? He's on his tsunami tour. He attracted 500,000 people in Rome and had tirades against corrupt politicians and bankers, which apparently Italians are totally ready to hear. They're fed up with their political class by the sound of it.
In a way, it's easier to explain the success of Beppe Grillo's five-star movement. This is a movement that clearly galvanizes all those who oppose the system, who feel who have been betrayed by the system. And clearly, with an economy doing so badly and with prospects so gloomy, it's not difficult to see why he has been so successful. I think it is more of a question mark why Mr. Monti's own electoral list has been doing so badly. According to the latest poll, he seems to be close to 10%. And to be, as you noticed, to come as a distant force in the current elections, if the polls that we have seen so far are going to be any connection with the final outcome. And I think a lot really reflects the unhappiness about the tax increases, the austerity-led policies that Mr. Monti has enacted, and he is now paying a heavy electoral toll for those policies.
And of course, Berlusconi is promising to cut taxes, right? That's his answer.
Actually, Mr. Berlusconi has been...
Oh, tax refunds.
Yes, but clearly Mr. Berlusconi is running on an anti-austerity policies platform, including the commitment he took to refund some of the tax increases put by Mr. Monti's own cabinet. And clearly, you know, some segments of the population who have been really, you know, short of cash, Mr. Berlusconi's appeal has definitely increased.
Again, I'm speaking with Domenico Lombardi, who is an expert on G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations and global currencies. His current projects focus on the recent international financial crisis, ongoing European crisis, and the reform of the IMF and the World Bank. And we're talking about the Italian elections taking place today. I believe they continue through tomorrow, do they not, Domenico?
Yes, you know, in Italy, usually you vote both on a Sunday and on a Monday, and therefore, you know, the polls will be closing tomorrow towards midday, and soon after they close, half an hour later, also the first polls will become available.
And apparently, I was surprised to learn that you have to be 25 years old to vote in Italy. Whereas it's 18 years old here.
That's right. In order to run for a seat in the lower chamber, you need to be at least 25 years of age. In order to run for a senatorial seat, that is for a seat in the upper chamber, you need to be at least 40 years old.
So tell us about the center-left Democratic Party led by Pierluigi Bersani. Is that the old Social Democrats?
It is a coalition that ranges from liberal Catholics to some leftist radical groups, and therefore it's you know, it boosts a wide range of politicians. Some are very reformist minded, some others are more radical, and actually have you know, openly said that they want to revert the Monti's agenda. And therefore, you know, Mr. Bersani is going to have a very tough job if he indeed becomes the prime minister, because he will have to, you know, build a really, you know, he will have to make sure that the radical groups in his own coalition will not block the reformist policies that his cabinet will have to implement. And this is a very tough call. And in the end, this is something that market investors will be watching very closely. And this is certainly, you know, the top priority for the new prime minister to implement reforms, not just tax increases or austerity reforms, but also structural reforms, liberalization in the product markets, further liberalization in the labor market. And it's not clear at all whether the center-left coalition, which is also very close to trade unions, radical trade unions, and other leftist groups, will be in the best position to do so.
And, of course, Mr. Bersani is a former communist, and he's been, throughout this election, he's been playing up his Catholic upbringing. That's a bit of a paradox, isn't it?
I would say Mr. Bersani is quite pragmatic. He's not dogmatic, and to his credit, one should say that when he was Minister for Economic Development in the Prodi cabinet a few years ago, he did try to implement a wide-ranging agenda of liberalization and reforms. I mean, it is also true that he was stopped by his own party members. And therefore, one will have to see whether, you know, this time Mr. Bersani will be more effective, will be able to win over the opposition of his own party members. Certainly, Italy's economy is doing very badly. There is really no prospect in the immediate for a resumption of growth. And therefore, he will have really to implement some shock therapy in order to bring the Italian economy back to growth. And that's not clear at all at this present stage.
Well, Domenico Lombardi, I mean, when I mentioned earlier that Silvio Berlusconi is up to mischief, I mean, I find it extraordinary to think that he could even have a political comeback after the endless scandals that surrounded his prime ministership. And on Friday, campaigning, he made this extraordinary promise. He said that if he won, he would personally refund the unpopular property tax paid by Italians in 2012. I will take 4 billion euros out of my fortune and give it to Italians, he said on television, pledging actually 5.3 billion. Surely people aren't that naive, are they? I mean, this is pretty naked patronage.
Mr. Berlusconi has shown to be very poignant, very tenacious, and he's certainly very smart at communicating with the people. Only a few months ago, I would say only actually a few weeks ago, no one would have bet a penny on you know, the electoral outcome he's likely to get on Monday. So, you know, when it comes to communication, I think there is no better politician. Clearly, communication is not the only factor. You also need an ambitious agenda. And I think this is really the question mark that is really surrounding his own coalition. To what extent Mr. Berlusconi will be instrumental in implementing ambitious reforms that he has not implemented in 20 years or so.
So you think he's got a political future then?
Mr. Berlusconi still has a certain political clout. Maybe he will not come back as a prime minister, but certainly there is a good chunk of the Italian electorate who is anti-communist, who's moderate by definition, and therefore, you know, he will still have a chance to sort of to affect the Italian political life, either directly or indirectly. And I think this is really the biggest question now, to what extent Mr. Berlusconi will be able to affect the Italian political life indirectly by sort of endorsing a new political leader. I think this is really the challenge for a new modern reformist center-right in Italy right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Domenico Lombardi, who's an expert on G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations and global currencies. His current projects focus on the recent international financial crisis, the ongoing European crisis, and reforms of the IMF and the World Bank. Now, how does what's going on in Italy, given that Mario Monti, the current prime minister, seems to be being punished for the austerity measures that he put through in order to satisfy the rest of Europe and particularly the Germans, I guess, and that's probably why Berlusconi is making an issue out of Angela Merkel. But it gets down to the same argument, doesn't it, Domenico, that we have here in the United States over the sequester. You know, when your economy is faltering and recovering, the last thing you do is take money out of a sick economy. And the Republicans are about to do that here in the United States. And so what are the similarities to your mind?
Well, I think there are some similarities, but also a lot of differences. First of all, the United States was running a deficit close to 13% at the height of the international financial crisis. Italy was nowhere close. Certainly, it's true, Italy has a high public debt. The United States, the United States debt has been rising quite fast as well. But the problem is that Italy is in a monetary union, and therefore it doesn't have an autonomous monetary policy. So the kind of very aggressive policies that the U.S. Federal Reserve has been enacting to prompt growth, that set of policies was simply unavailable in the Eurozone because the European Central Bank is much more conservative. Also, most recently, there has been an improvement on that side too. The problem is that clearly when your fiscal stance is unsustainable, when you start running high deficits or you have a high public debt, clearly you have to put your house in order. But it doesn't pay anyone if you do that abruptly, if this adjustment is front-loaded. You just compress aggregate demand, you just fill expectations of a contracting economy. No one is willing to spend. So really what you have to do is to manage very carefully a trade-off where you're going to be supportive of aggregate demand in the short run, But at the same time, he also laid down a credible, balanced, medium to long-term path of deficit and debt reduction. And I think really this is, you know, the crux of the debate here in the United States, to what extent you have to support short-term, domestic demand in the short-term versus long-term. In Italy and in some other euro area countries, they just, applied the brakes without really taking into consideration the consequences of that. And I think now many Italian households are just paying the consequences of that.
Well, just to change the subject slightly, Domenico Lombardi, when I was mentioning earlier Berlusconi's sexcapades with the young prostitute and sex parties and stuff, which seemed to be kind of endless scandals during his tenure. If he's doing well in the polls, then would that suggest then that the moralistic side of Italian life, led by the Catholic Church, has lost some of its credibility because of all these scandals going on with the Church? I don't know whether you were following the story in Repubblica and Panorama about their report of why they thought the Pope resigned because of a sex scandal within the Vatican itself.
I don't really know. I know that the judiciary is certainly investigating on that. But I would say that the difficulty of the of many Italian households go well beyond, you know, the sort of sexual sphere of anybody. And I think really what is at stake in this election is what kind of future, you know, Italians imagine for themselves, whether it's a future of, you know, more austerity, whether it's, you know, whether they want to take this opportunity to express a feeling of protest, of opposition to the austerity policies that have been imposed on them. And, you know, whether they want Italy to be a little bit more dialectic with Germany and with Europe. It doesn't mean to be a Eurosceptical. It doesn't mean to want the country exit from the Eurozone. But certainly this kind of one-way policymaking, where policies are made in Berlin and then they are imposed on the rest of the Eurozone, certainly will be something that needs to be revised.
Well, Domenico Lombardi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Domenico Lombardi, who's an expert on G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations, and global currencies. His current projects focus on the recent international financial crisis, the ongoing European crisis, and reforms of the IMF and the World Bank. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was